It is Thursday, February 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence pledges solidarity with South Korea. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson calls for political reform in Venezuela.
We intend to take all actions possible to persuade the regime to return to its full constitutional authorities, return it to the hands of the Venezuelan people.
And we visit a so-called nap cafe where busy Washingtonians can catch up on their sleep. It's all ahead. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence has assured South Korea the United States will stand with its allies to bring maximum pressure on North Korea to end its nuclear and ballistic missile program. Pence arrived in South Korea on Thursday to counter North Korea's Olympic charm offensive in ways that could create a rift with South Korea's engagement efforts. VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman is traveling with the vice president, and he spoke with me from Seoul.
In the words of the vice president, the United States stands shoulder to shoulder with South Korea. That's a phrase we've heard for a long time. And what both of the leaders are emphasizing is that their goal is to eliminate the nuclear weapons program from North Korea. Of course, this is all happening at a very interesting time with South Korea hosting the Olympics and athletes from North Korea coming, and also some high-level dignitaries from Pyongyang, including the sister of leader Kim Jong-un. And there is a possibility, which Vice President Pence and others have acknowledged, that there could be some sort of meeting between one of the North Korean officials and Vice President Pence. They keep saying, we'll see what happens. And so they're definitely not ruling it out, although both Pyongyang and Washington are saying they're not asking for a meeting with each other.
Yeah, and Mr. Pence has warned against, I believe, what he terms as the charm offensive by North Korea. And he also spoke to U.S. troops in Japan earlier in the day. And what did he tell them?
Well, that was a really tough speech. And speaking to a hangar full of U.S. service personnel, where he was flanked by a couple of F-35 stealth fighter jets from the U.S. Air Force, the vice president talked essentially about being prepared for any eventuality. And I asked the vice president following that speech if that address was intended to prepare American servicemen and women for war. And he paused for a couple of seconds before he answered. He had a long, indirect answer, but he did use that phrase that we have heard again and again in recent months, that, quote, all options are on the table.
This is all occurring as the same day North Korea held a military parade in Pyongyang. It's an interesting time to have a military parade as the Olympics are preparing to begin.
Yeah, this, according to Pyongyang, was tied to an anniversary of its army. But obviously, coming on the same day that the first athletic competitions were happening in South Korea at the Olympics, it definitely helped to take some of the focus off of what was happening in the South. And as we've seen time and time again, North Korea always wants to have attention paid to it. And the United States talks about maximum pressure. Well, North Korea, through its provocative actions for some years, has also, in a sense, been applying maximum pressure.
That's VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman reporting from Seoul, South Korea. Time now for social media. Former President George W. Bush said Thursday that there's pretty clear evidence that the Russians meddled in the 2016 American presidential election. His comments seem to rebut fellow Republican Donald Trump's denials of Moscow trying to affect the vote. While never mentioning President Trump by name, Bush appeared to be pushing back on Trump's attempts to have warmer relations with Russia, as well as his comments on immigration. The White House did not immediately comment on Bush's remarks. Bush spoke at a talk in Abu Dhabi, the capital of the United Arab Emirates. U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded Russia meddled in the 2016 election to help Trump win. Numerous investigations are underway to determine whether Trump's campaign aided the Kremlin in its efforts. Trump has repeatedly denied any collusion with Russia. Ron Hanforth tweeted, "So now liberals are taking hashtag George Bush, the hanging Chad guy, seriously when he said pretty clear evidence Russia meddled in U.S. election. Remember when they used to call him a Nazi or Hitler?" But at Failed Evolution tweets, "Democrats love George Bush and the FBI now. What happened?" Well, also trending is hashtag Eagles Parade, the celebration for the Super Bowl victor, the Philadelphia Eagles. Eagles Flyers Pocono tweets, "Don't let today's Eagles Parade distract you from the fact that the Eagles won more playoff games in the last 4 weeks than the Dallas Cowboys have in 22 years. And USA Today tweets, "The five-mile trek through the city will conclude at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, where Sylvester Stallone climbed those famous steps in the Rocky movies." And that's a look at social media. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. U.S. lawmakers race to pass a two-year budget deal before the midnight funding deadline. President Trump says religious faith is central to American life and liberty. Former Bangladesh leader Khalida Zia is sentenced to 5 years in prison, and the International Criminal Court opens a probe into Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte's anti-drug war. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA. This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, some of the best chefs in France win Michelin awards. This week, Venezuela announced it will hold elections April 22nd. It appears the opposition is divided, giving embattled socialist president Nicolas Maduro a leg up on winning re-election. Meanwhile, negotiations between the Maduro government and the opposition in the Dominican Republic collapsed. Those developments came as U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson wrapped up a week-long trip through Latin America, where he's tried to generate support for reform in Venezuela. He spoke alongside Jamaican Prime Minister Andrew Holness in Kingston.
This is one of the things that binds Jamaica and the U.S. so closely, is strong commitment to democratic values. And it's why we're just both heartbroken to see what's happening in Venezuela, as we're seeing what was once a thriving democracy dismantled before our very eyes. And it's the reason we intend to take all actions possible to persuade the regime to return to its full constitutional authorities, return it to the hands of the Venezuelan people. I think there's great unanimity in the region and certainly in the hemisphere that we all want to see some progress on this situation in Venezuela, which only gets worse day by day.
Tillerson said possible sanctions on Venezuela's oil exports will be the object of discussions with Canada and Mexico to ease the effect of such sanctions on the regional economy, where some countries benefit from subsidized oil from Venezuela. David Smildy, a Tulane University sociology professor and a senior fellow at the Washington Office on Latin America, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the Venezuelan opposition remains on the defensive.
There's not an agreement on whether or not to go to elections. It's very clear. Everyone agrees that the situation is not fair. The electoral mechanisms are not functioning, and they don't treat the opposition fairly. But some people think that they should go to elections anyway because they really have such a numeric advantage that even if the situation is not fair, they could probably still win. And even if they don't, that would force the government's hand, it would force the government to reveal its authoritarianness. But other people say that, no, they shouldn't even participate in a farce. And so that has the opposition completely divided. That's why they ended up losing the elections in October, because they couldn't turn out their people. And in December, they tried to boycott the elections, but then some people still ran anyway. And so that didn't work out very well either. Really, any strategy they choose doesn't work very well because they're so disunified.
If you had the chance to counsel the opposition, what would you tell them, boycott or participate?
Well, I think that it would be better for them to participate, because I think even if the situation is unfair, it's better to force the government's hand and make government reveal its authoritarian character.
David, what happened to the negotiations going on in the Dominican Republic? Why did they collapse?
They've been going on for a while, and there's been discussion of a document that the negotiators had put forward. The two versions of the document are circulating. The one the government wanted everyone to sign said that the elections would be in April. It also included recognition for, or at least tacit recognition for, the Constituent Assembly, which the opposition thinks is illegitimate. And it also didn't really have provisions for humanitarian aid. The opposition version wanted much more specific provisions for international observation of the election. It also wanted its people, such as Enrique Capriles and Leopoldo Lopez, to be available for the election. They're currently disqualified from running. And they, in the end, they couldn't really come to an agreement on these things. And I think it's understandable that the opposition wouldn't sign a document, because it was, in many key points, it was quite vague.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is wrapping up a tour through Latin America. And one constant theme has been rallying the troops, if you will, against Venezuela and making it return to the Constitution. How successful was his persuasive abilities?
I don't think he had a whole lot of persuasion. I mean, I think it showed that the United States is quite serious about this. And I think the fact that he mentioned oil sanctions any number of times certainly gets people's attention. So hopefully this will get other Latin American countries to pressure the Maduro government more.
David Smiley said, while sanctions on Venezuelan oil demonstrates the seriousness of the situation to the U.S., some Latin countries are doubtful that will force the Maduro government to accept reform while threatening to make the refugee exodus from Venezuela even worse. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A machine that can read minds might be more at home in a science fiction movie, but researchers using a magnetic resonance device read the minds of volunteers to determine what song they were listening to. Scientists at Brazil's De Ouro Institute for Research and Education selected 6 volunteers and had them listen to 40 pieces of classical music, rock, pop, jazz, and other genres while connected to the MR device. The machine captured the neural fingerprint of each song on the volunteer's brain, while a computer using this data learned to identify the brain patterns produced by each musical selection. Given a choice between 2 songs, the computer, with 85% accuracy, was able to correctly identify the song the participants were listening to based on the brain activity. Researchers plan to find out what makes some people love a song while others don't. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. France's top chefs crowded on stage earlier this week to receive their coveted Michelin stars at an award ceremony just outside of Paris. VOA's Steve Miller has the story.
More than 50 new French restaurants were added to the internationally known Michelin Guide, which awards culinary excellence around the world given out by 1, 2, or 3-star ratings. The criteria for a Michelin star include high-quality products, fine cooking, consistency of the meals and service, and the chef's personality reflected in the cuisine. Michelin Executive Vice President Claire Dorland-Clausel said the latest group of winners proves that French cuisine is alive and rich.
It's really the world's best. We have young chefs, chefs of different nationalities, and this proves that the heritage exists. It's a very rich selection.
For most cooks, the award is a dream come true, a recognition of their establishment, skill, and hard work, as well as a 20% to 30% increase in restaurant revenue. But recently, some French chefs gave up their stars due to the high pressure of constantly living up to set standards. In September 2017, three-starred chef Sebastian Braz bowed out of the Michelin Guide, a first, saying he wished to continue his passion with a free spirit and without stress. And Hugues Gonnet, a chef at Le Saltico, says a Michelin star isn't his drive.
Today, to get a Michelin star, everyone knows what has to be done to get it. But it's a lot of pressure to have a Michelin star, and it means even more work. I already work a lot. It's not my primary quest.
In total, this year's Michelin Guide features 621 French restaurants. Among the newcomers are 50 new one-star restaurants, 5 new two-stars, and 2 new three-stars, including Marc Veyrat's restaurant, La Maison de Bois.
We've had so much bad luck in our lives. We had too many stars. We were forced to stop because I had a terrible accident. I had to get back in the game, and I didn't want to be graded. And the head of the Michelin Guide came to see me and said, "No, chef, you should do it." So I threw myself back into this incredible competition, and I snagged my third star a year and a half after opening.
Michelin will release this year's guide on Friday, February 9th. Steve Miller, VOA News.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Working long hours as an IT consultant, Daniel Turcini used to always feel tired by the middle of his workday. He asked other business professionals around him what they do and where they go to re-energize. The answers varied from taking a nap in their car in the garage or a nearby hotel lobby just to fall asleep on their desk. At this point, Turcini realized that overworked, overstressed people need a quiet place to take a break and rest. And as Faiza Almasri tells us, he founded that place, the city's first nap cafe, and called it Recharge. Faith Lapidus narrates.
Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, is home to government agencies, international financial institutions, and all kinds of high-powered firms and corporations. In the heart of this busy city where people work for long hours, Recharge opened a few months ago. People drop by from around the city for a break.
Hi, Daniel. How are you?
After turning off all electronic devices, customers go to one of the sleep cocoons separated by white curtains hanging from the ceiling. Inside these pods, beanbag beds, blankets, and lavender-scented eye masks allow them to fall asleep to soft music. After a 20-minute nap, they're awakened and go back to work refreshed.
We've seen D.C. and Washingtonians, myself included, adopt this with open arms.
Daniel Turcini says Recharge offers an antidote to our fast-paced lifestyle, the opportunity to slow down.
Some of the distractions that we're facing today, we've never seen before. So smartphones tethered to our belts 24/7. So your boss can contact you at all hours of the night or even when you're on vacation. This is a challenge we really never had a generation ago.
To help clients improve their physical and mental wellness, Recharge also offers guided meditation sessions. Senior teacher Paige Lichens uses different tools to help her students stay mindful of the moment.
Listening to relaxing sounds allows them to step into a place of putting away their other thoughts and lay back and listen. The sounds specifically have different areas where they're working into different vibrations in a person's body. So beyond that, a lot of them will end up talking about an experience of lightness or floating. They were uncertain of where they were, but they just relaxed deeper than had they just laid down and tried to sleep.
IT consultant Connor Garrity says he comes to Recharge almost every day.
You feel, I guess, feels like your day's just beginning instead of, oh my God, how am I going to get through the rest of the day? So I come here a lot too, like after the workday, and even that is just as helpful because you're re-energized.
Attorney Maria Ponte says she feels tired and stressed out at work.
What I like the most about coming here is that I can breathe, whereas my morning is very crazy, very hectic. I drink a lot of coffee, and so I'm like moving too much too fast. So when I come here, it helps me stop time and just balance my day.
The guided meditations help Aponte relieve her physical tension as well.
A lot of the things that they do include like a body scan, and you try to figure out which areas you're carrying more stress and which areas you can soften. My problem is usually here in my jaws. This is where I hold most of my tension. So it helps me loosen this area.
Recharge's experts also offer wellness workshops at other locations.
There's a return on investment that companies get from ensuring and promoting health and wellness activities within their organization. So we teach them different tools that are tenable in an office environment so that they can find a little bit of calm in the middle of the day. But more than that, they can learn to manage their energy throughout the day so they can actually be more productive.
As the trend of promoting wellness and healthy habits continues, the business of midday breaks is expected to grow and thrive. Daniel Turacini, Recharge founder, is proud to be one of the pioneers. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns the reported arrests of at least 29 protesters in Iran for exercising their human rights and fundamental freedoms by standing up against the compulsory hijab imposed upon women. U.S. Department of State spokesperson Heather Nauert wrote in a statement that the United States remains steadfast in our support for the rights to freedom of religion, freedom of expression, and peaceful assembly. President Donald Trump has said that the Iranian people are the source of one of the greatest fears of the Iranian government. That fear has been shown once again by the regime's reaction to women who protest the compulsory wearing of the hijab. Images and videos of unveiled Iranian women standing up and waving their hijab are spreading across social media. Some men and veiled women have also protested the compulsory hijab. They are motivated and inspired by the action of a young Iranian woman who stood on a box in Enghelab or Revolution Street in Tehran prior to the massive anti-government protests that started at the end of December. Omid Memarian, a U.S.-based Iranian journalist who was once imprisoned in Iran, wrote on social media that the fight against forced hijab is not about whether the hijab is good or bad. It's about choice and equality. As the U.S. Department of State's 2016 Human Rights Report noted, Iranian women's rights are restricted in virtually all areas of society. Not only must they adhere to the compulsory hijab, but their testimony is given half the weight of a man's in a court of law. They may not transmit citizenship to their children or to a non-citizen spouse. They are barred from running for high political office, Social and legal restraints limit their educational and professional opportunities, and they are punished disproportionately for certain crimes. The women of Iran deserve better. They deserve to be accorded their full fundamental human rights, as the current protests over the compulsory hijab underscore. In State Department spokesperson Nowert's words, people should be free to choose the clothes they wear and practice their faith as they desire. Depriving individuals of this choice undermines their autonomy and dignity.